private conversations so that we can all begin a public conversation in this next session. So should we just, yes, all take your seats, please. And welcome to the final session of today. My name is Gwyn Prince. I'm a research professor jointly at the London School of Economics and at Columbia in New York, known by some of my colleagues slightly unkindly, I think, as the Virgin Professor for the amount of time that I spend with the little virgins out at Heathrow Airport. But there we are. We're going this afternoon to address a very carefully chosen title, Meeting Global Security Challenges. Well, we knew that because that's on the leaflet, but we have an additional word, which is together. And we're going to be together not only with our panel, but also with colleagues from Harvard who are with us now, I hope, on the monitor. Yes, I can see them. Harvard, can you see us? Hello, Harvard. How nice to see you. Let me tell you, Harvard, how we're going to do this. We're going to listen to our panelists, who I'll introduce in a moment. And then, after each of them has spoken for no more than 10 minutes, we will then start the questioning. You will be listening as assiduously as the audience in London, and I'll then, as the questions come up, take them alternately. We'll have to work out some sort of signaling process so that we know when you've got a question to ask, but I'm sure that we can make that up as we go along. Right, meeting global
Thank
security.
You very-
Hello? Was that a note from Harvard? Hi. Did you want to say something?
I just said thank you very much.
Great. It's nice that you're there and that we're here. Isn't technology marvelous? Right. Meeting global security challenges together. Everybody in the room, I'm sure, will recognize, as I'm sure the panelists do, that there is not only one NATO. There are, in fact, two. There is the NATO that is run by Mr. de Hoop-Schaffer, which is an organization of states that has offices and alliance documents and forces which are talked about and controlled in Brussels. But there is another NATO as well, a sort of virtual NATO. And that is the worldwide sharing of many of the procedures for the control and command of military forces, which is used by most states that use their forces in serious ways. And that's true of all of the countries here represented on this afternoon's panel. Because with me we have on my right His Excellency Richard Alston, the Australian High Commissioner here in London. And Richard, it's a very great pleasure that you're able to spare the time to be with us today. Australia, as has, I believe, already been remarked during this morning, has been playing an enormous, I mean, I think one might even say, given the size of the country's forces, disproportionately important role in many vital international operations. To my left, we have Her Excellency Dr. Malila Lodi, the High Commissioner for Pakistan in the United Kingdom. And High Commissioner, we're very honored and delighted that you're able to be with us here as well, particularly since we share an LSE connection. Dr. Lodi is going to be offering us a perspective which matters to all of us intensely, because she will be speaking from a developing world and a Muslim country's perspective in her remarks. Dr. Sergei Rogov, on the far right of the table.
No, I'm on the extreme left. What the audience.
But as I was about to remark, on the extreme left, from the point of view of the audience, therefore represents geographically and physically precisely the transformation through which he and his career and his country has passed. And he will be offering us a unique perspective, because Dr. Rogoff, who I've had the pleasure of knowing on and off for many years, is director of the Institute of USA and Canada Studies in Moscow. He's been a long-time observer with an always amusing and sometimes jaundiced eye, Sergei, I think we might say. And on the other end, let me not mix up left and right, we have Dr. Makio Miyagawa, the director of the Japan Institute for International Relations. I think, Dr. Miyagawa, you might agree that for many Europeans, we've gone through a curious decade with Japan in that people didn't think about Japan quite as much as they had done before. There were sometimes articles in the Financial Times about Japan having some sort of nervous breakdown. But actually, we now have a situation, a great achievement, I might say, of the North Korean regime, which has placed your prime minister side by side with the Chinese prime minister, shoulder to shoulder with the Australian government and with the NATO allies, in the position over the North Korean nuclear crisis. So we're moving into new times with new forms of engagement. That's quite enough from me. It therefore offers me great pleasure to ask His Excellency Richard Alston if he'd like to take the floor to offer us his remarks on meeting global security challenges together.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Gwyn. Perhaps I will speak from here. Most of the morning session, I think, has been largely devoted to the Northern Hemisphere, so you're at least getting some global balance this afternoon. And from my perspective, of course, I speak on behalf of a country that is probably the most remote from NATO and Europe, and even, I suppose, from the United States. So we have a unique perspective. We're a very prosperous, resource-rich country, not only in the centre of Southeast Asia, but on the Pacific Rim, where there are quite a number of micro and small states who present particular challenges. And I suppose until the dawn of the information economy in the 90s, we were pretty much on the other side of the world. It never occurred to us that NATO was likely to be immediately relevant, and NATO probably didn't think much more about our relevance. But since that time, of course, with the death of distance, we've only become a mouse click away, and it means that we are very much part and parcel of all that goes on in the world these days, 13th largest economy, for example. Now, the challenges that face us in many ways are shared challenges with others, so the global threat of terrorism, proliferation of WMD and missile technology, and all of the even worse add-ons, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, these are in prospect, at least in theory, and one would hope not in practice, but they're certainly threats that we have to confront. But what's unique about our location is the presence of a number of weak and failing states close by and even well out into the Pacific region. And they, of course, can very easily become training grounds for terrorists. All the consequences that flow from being a basket case usually lead you in precisely the wrong direction in terms of global security. Pandemics and natural disasters are other challenges that we face, perhaps more than some others. Certainly we're probably the drought capital of the world. So we give priority to our immediate region, but we also recognise that we have international responsibilities and global interests. As a major resource supplier, for example, 30% of the world's coal trade, probably going to be number two in the world in terms of LNG in the next 10 years, 40% of the world's proven uranium resources. So we've got an acute vested interest in international stability and certainly energy security issues. We currently have serving overseas about 3,000 troops, which is about 10% of our total armed forces, which I think is on a par with the UK. So we think we're pulling our weight. We'd be in some 9 countries. We've been in Afghanistan for quite a while. We've got about 400 troops there. And in Iraq, we've got close to 1,500. East Timor was a particular challenge for us. We've got about 1,100 or 1,200 there as well. And we've recently increased the size of our defence force by a couple of battalions. And we've generally taken a range of measures which we think NATO would very much approve of. Now, Southeast Asia is actually one of the major fronts in this global battle. We've experienced it directly, not on our land mass, but very close by with Bali on two occasions. The first occasion we lost 88 people out of 202, and our own embassy in Jakarta was bombed only a couple of years ago. So we've endeavoured to negotiate with a number of the countries in the region to strike MOUs with them on counter-terrorism, but we understand the challenges that they face. Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, is fighting the good fight, but nonetheless there are some very dangerous organisations there, like Jamaah Islamiyah, and the spiritual head of that organisation is free and loose and able to inspire others. So it does provide us with some very important challenges. The regional architecture, APEC, always been primarily an economic forum, but it's become much more concerned with security issues. ASEAN also has a regional forum. That's a much broader operation these days, and it does involve a number of the major players like the US, India and China, and I think Pakistan's in there as well. So we play our part in those areas, and they are important in terms of maintaining the stability of the region. We've also signed on very much to the Proliferation Security Initiative and the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism, which was announced in St. Petersburg some little time back. So these are all issues that I think are ones that Australia wants to play its part in. But in terms of weak and failing states, it's not altogether a happy story, because just as NATO is still in Bosnia and Kosovo, we have been pouring a lot of aid into Papua New Guinea since forever. It got its independence in 75. We're still giving it about, say, 100, 200 million pounds a year, and it still has very endemic corruption problems. British Solomon Islands, again, very serious issues. Even Fiji, which you would think is one of the largest South Pacific countries, again, they've had a couple of coups and it's usually fairly unstable. So even though we've set up various arrangements to try and consolidate the relationship, assist them in terms of law enforcement and governance issues, we've made our aid much more tied to improvements on those fronts. It's still a very difficult challenge, and you can't just go on pouring money into these countries without seeing some discernible improvement, but you know that if you even think of walking away, someone else will step in, and that may not be a positive influence. And if they're left to their own resources, then they can often become havens for terrorism, transnational crime, narcotic centres, and all those signs of a failed state. So they present very particular challenges. Now, if I can just deal with the relationship with NATO. NATO, as we've heard this morning, is keen to extend its range, not necessarily a full membership, but contact countries, which include Australia. And for our part, we certainly regard NATO as a very important force for good globally. And therefore, we've substantially increased our relationships. In fact, our troop commitment in Afghanistan is the first time we've really had much to do with NATO. But in the last few years, we've engaged in quite a number of new initiatives, intelligence sharing, providing joint training exercises to try and enable interoperability to occur between NATO forces and our own. There's a particular initiative to try and deal with dirty bombs. And I think in a number of ways we see NATO as very much an organisation that we would like to get closer to. So that is essentially the challenge in the region, and I think it's a matter of all cooperating as much as possible. We tend to be a fairly major player, if you like, a big fish in a small pond, but we can't do it alone any more than NATO or Europe can do it alone. So we see those wider linkages as being very important ones indeed, and as a result of that, I think we will continue to work closely with NATO. We've already got a defence advisor attached to NATO. We've contributed equipment to a mine clearing operation in Azerbaijan, and there's other opportunities for cooperation come along, I'm sure we'll be very keen to be involved. So perhaps I could leave it there.
Thank you, High Commissioner. That's extremely interesting and gives us already the beginning, as you say, of a global perspective. So without further ado, to the other High Commissioner, please.
Thank you. Thank you, and thanks for this opportunity to share our views with such a distinguished audience. Let me first say a few words about Pakistan's pivotal status in the region, and then I will, from Pakistan's perspective, give you an overview of where we see global threats and global challenges coming from. So first, very quickly, for four reasons, Pakistan is regarded as a pivotal state. Pivotal to regional peace and stability, pivotal to outcomes which will determine peace and stability in our region, indeed global peace and stability as well. And these are, first, Pakistan's geostrategic location. We just happen to be located where we are, straddling three key regions of the world, South Asia, Central Asia, and of course the adjacent Middle East, Southwest Asia and the Middle East. These have been historically regions of great volatility, but they are also now regions of great economic opportunity. The second is, of course, Pakistan's demographics. We happen to be the sixth most populous nation in the world. But more important than the fact that we just happen to have a very large population is the fact that we have a very large base of educated, skilled professionals, many of whom, sadly, we've exported to many parts of the world and who are, in fact, making a mark in countries ranging from the United States to Canada to the United Kingdom. The third reason why Pakistan is rightly seen as a pivotal state is because of its Muslim identity. We are the second largest Muslim nation in the world, and I won't elaborate. I think it's self-evident. Fourth, I would say Pakistan's economic potential. We see ourselves in the future as a regional economic hub, connecting many regions through providing corridors of cooperation in trade, in energy, in many other ways in which we can link China on the one hand, Central Asian states on the other hand, down to the port in Gwadar, which is being constructed now as I speak. And from this perspective, let me now say how we see global challenges. It's very clear to us that today's threats do not respect borders, they are interconnected, and of course they require responses at regional, global, and of course national levels. We live in a globalized world, it's pretty obvious, in which prosperity has spread, but so has poverty. And our security challenges have become globalized. They used to say all politics is local. Well, it seems all threats today are no longer local. They have global implications. Security challenges also are no longer military threats. 15 years after the Cold War ended, we don't live in a safer world. Sadly, we confront different kinds of threats and conflicts. But it is also true that in this globalized world, the opportunities for working together to address insecurity across the globe are also unprecedented. Today, and I will now quickly walk you through the threats as we see them across the world. States, communities, and societies are threatened by both hard and soft security threats. The hard threats obviously emanate from old and new conflicts and disputes among states and within states increasingly. And secondly, of course, from terrorism, especially from globalized networks such as Al-Qaeda. And third, from the proliferation of WMD, weapons of mass destruction, and the accompanying failure to promote meaningful disarmament in both the nuclear and conventional fields. Now, the soft threats to security, in our view, imperil human life even more than hard threats, because poverty today, and I think it's shameful, still stalks two-thirds of mankind in a century where we've seen so much progress. This has led to economic collapse, social chaos, and inevitably disputes and conflicts, both internal and external. It is no coincidence that 90% of current conflicts are to be found in the poorest 30% of countries in the world. We believe that the international trade and financial system favors those already prosperous, and there is a need, therefore, to go and see what we need to do about this to create more level playing fields. Specific decisions and actions are required in each of the areas where we do face these globalized threats, both of the hard and soft variety. In fact, this is a distinction, frankly, which is out there in the literature, but in actual operation, the picture is much more confused. Hard threats are also soft threats. Soft threats are also hard threats in terms of their consequences. Now, the resolution of conflicts and disputes, obviously, across the world requires strong commitment and engagement by the world's major powers. And we feel that globally priority must be given to the solution of complex disputes in the Middle East, Palestine, the restoration of Lebanon's sovereignty and cohesion, the promotion of sectarian peace and preservation of the unity of Iraq, accompanied by an early end to foreign military presence in that country, the peaceful resolution of questions regarding Iran's nuclear program, of course, the stabilization of Afghanistan. We, being a neighbor, have confronted, in a sense, the heaviest fallout from prolonged strife in our neighborhood. And I think what we're looking for in Afghanistan is how to confront in an integrated way, how to respond in an integrated way the multifaceted security challenges that we face, including a newly resurgent Taliban insurgency. And finally, of course, to be able to address the long-running dispute in our region of South Asia between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Now, we feel that solutions to a whole host of these disputes must be promoted through a combination of the United Nations, especially the Security Council, acting resolutely with the support of regional and major powers. Of course, combating terrorism is a very high priority, and Pakistan is placed on the front lines in fighting this war. And this has to also be confronted by a combination of national and international cooperation and action. We know that it has to be frontally addressed through effective police and intelligence sharing and actions, as well as by the use of force, including the implementation of measures contained in various international covenants as well as Security Council resolutions. But if we are to succeed in eliminating terrorism, we must also address and eliminate its underlying causes. To understand causes is not to justify terrorism. It is only to find the means to overcoming terrorism. And here, I think, one of the greatest challenges of our age is how to reconcile and harmonize divergent conceptions of the Muslim world and the West. Now, I'm generalizing. There may be differences. How the West and the Muslim world conceptualize root causes. Again, this is a generalization. Many in the West, not all, but many in the West increasingly take what we believe is a behavioral approach to root causes, while people in the Muslim world generally take a structuralist view of root causes. In other words, leading voices in the West are increasingly focused on the evil ideology that has to be countered, whereas we in the Muslim world place greater emphasis on foreign occupation and political and economic injustices that provide incubation or breeding grounds for people who then resort to violence. I believe I have very little time, so I will only say that on WMD proliferation also, there is a need for a new consensus on non-proliferation, and I think one of the most important parts of that new consensus has to be a non-discriminatory approach to implementing non-proliferation rules and not a selective and discriminatory approach. And I think if I was, from my country's perspective, to summarize the three key components of this new consensus that we need on non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament, because both have to go hand in hand. People seem to have forgotten all about commitments given about disarmament many, many years ago. I would summarize them as follows. First, a renewed commitment by the nuclear weapon states to nuclear disarmament, commitments that they'd undertaken themselves. Second, normalization of the relationship between the NPT regime and the three regimes or the three states outside the NPT. A non-discriminatory framework would be my third important pillar for such a new consensus, a non-discriminatory framework for the promotion of peaceful nuclear cooperation. We have to find peaceful solutions to the Iranian question, to what is happening in the Korean Peninsula, which concerns us as much as it concerns the rest of the world. But I think it is important to recognize and implement the fact that there can't be favorites about which countries are entitled to owning an entire fuel cycle while others are denied that right on criteria and basis that frankly amount to a discriminatory regime. So I think we need much clearer rules and much more non-discriminatory implementation of these rules if we are to go anywhere. And finally, I will, you know, really take a lot of questions when they are posed to me on specifically Pakistan's role vis-a-vis Afghanistan. But I do want to round off by saying that among the most important challenges for us, where we are, and I think for most countries in the developing world, especially countries in Africa, is to ensure that the international commitment that was given to implement what were called the Millennium Development Goals, and one of them, remember, was to halve world poverty by 2015. We hope that this commitment will not wane and erode by strategic distractions. And that's very important. Countries must live up to the commitments that they made, because poverty threatens us just as much as the hard threats that I talked about. Let me say that at the end, Pakistan continues to play a huge role, not just vis-a-vis Afghanistan. Today, my country is the second largest contributor to UN peacekeeping forces across the world. So we in Pakistan take the responsibility of upholding peace and security very seriously. We are cooperating with NATO in our neighborhood, but we're also contributing to UN peacekeeping forces across the world. Thank you.
Commissioner, thank you very much indeed for extremely clear and very thought-provoking remarks. And I'm sure, as you said, you will elicit many questions, and we will have about half an hour for that when our speakers have finished making their contributions, of whom the next will be, please, Dr. Rogoff.
Thank you very much, Gwen. Since I'm taking very strong medicine against high blood pressure, I'm not allowed to consume alcohol. So I'm afraid you're going to hear the voice of sobriety this afternoon. It's been fashionable to talk about new security threats, non-traditional security threats, terrorism, drugs, international crime, global warming, and that's correct. But I'm going to talk today about the traditional security threats related to the so-called hard power. And my main message is that the post-Cold War world order has collapsed. So we are entering a very dangerous new period. Point number one. When the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union disappeared, the bipolar system of international relations disappeared. In the United States and the West, this was interpreted as victory in the Cold War. And in the last decade or more, the main goal, strategic goal of American policy was to consolidate the fruits of this victory, to consolidate the positions of the United States as a single superpower, to consolidate a unipolar structure of the international system. And America has serious credentials for these claims. 30% of the global GDP at the exchange rate, almost half of the capitalization of the global market, more than 50% of global military expenditures, and almost 70% of the global expenditures on defense research and development. So, well, it seemed nobody could compete with the United States. And this drive, I think, became apparent, absolutely obvious during the first term of the Bush administration. But Iraq turned out to be a turning point. And it's very clear that there is no victory for the United States in Iraq. So if there is no victory, What's then? A defeat? And one can speculate about two possible scenarios. More or less an orderly retreat by the United States, like it happened after Vietnam. By the way, the Vietnamese didn't come after that to America to blow up Americans. Or it could be a more disastrous situation. So the Bush administration is trying to stay the course. But I think it's clear that within 2 years, the United States will be on its way out of Iraq. I don't think that the United States will leave Iraq completely, but this will be an event which will have tremendous global repercussions. Since we will be returning to the international situation which to some extent existed as a century ago. The multipolar world, when the rules of the game are not clear, when there is no mechanism for enforcement of these rules, and this is an invitation to trouble. Point number two, this is going to happen at the moment when the arms control regime, which was negotiated at the end of the Cold War, is dying. You know that the United States decided to withdraw from the ABM Treaty, START II was not ratified, CTBT was not ratified, chemical and biological weapons agreements are in big trouble. I must tell you, the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty also is in trouble. And that means that the bilateral arms control regime, which was a stabilizing mechanism during the Cold War between Russia and the United States, is coming to an end. In 2 years, START I expires, and there are no plans for negotiations for another agreement. In 6 years, the Strategic Offensive Reduction Treaty, which Bush and Putin signed, expires. And what's then? But we are entering a situation when there are many players with their ambitions and which possess quite important power. And there are no limitations for other nuclear powers. At the same time, the non-proliferation regime, which was supposed to maintain the status quo, also is collapsing. I think that the 21st century started in 1998 when India and Pakistan tested their nuclear weapons. Last week, North Korea tested something. By the way, North Koreans apparently feel that the United States is a paper tiger, that the United States is simply unable to run a second large-scale ground war while it is engaged in Iraq. These very special mechanisms to manage the balance of power, which were developed during the Cold War and never existed during the Cold War. Remember, arms control was a nice idea before the Cold War, but it never worked. And apparently we are coming to this new situation when we are not going to have these mechanisms to regulate the competition. Point number three, the so-called BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Let me start in reverse order. China is continuing to grow, and apparently China is the only country which in this century could become the second superpower. And this huge economic potential which China is developing also is going to have an impact in the military field. Since the Chinese feel a double threat to their nuclear deterrence today, on the one hand, ballistic missile defense deployment by the United States in Alaska, California, and Aegis systems in the Japan Sea, which is a threat to the Chinese nuclear credibility of Chinese nuclear deterrence. On the other hand, India is developing its own nuclear triad. And we should pay attention to very serious geopolitical and geostrategic competition which goes on between India and China. It reminds me of sometimes of British-French competition in the end of the 19th century when they were looking for coal stations. Now, well, you have the Chinese and Indians from Africa to Latin America looking for oil, gas and other energy sources. I'm not going to speak much about Brazil, but a few words about Russia. Russia went through a very difficult period in the 90s when we started a deep transformation, transition to political democracy and market reforms without any comprehensive strategy. That was very painful. And Russia went into a decline. And at some point, Russian international influence became extremely limited. The situation has changed in recent years. Apparently, under Putin, Russia reached a certain level of political stability. At least nobody is questioning Putin's authority in Russia anymore. And Russia is experiencing economic recovery, mostly thanks to high oil and gas prices. But that's a lot of money which Russia is getting today. And that changed the situation. Russia had to speak from a position of weakness for many years. Today, you can read Russia is not going to accept anymore a situation when it is presented with a fait accompli. And I'm coming to the last point, NATO. NATO is a very successful alliance. Historically, it's the only alliance which survived its victory over the opponent. So when the Soviet Union disappeared, NATO didn't end its career and is alive and kicking. But NATO is experiencing serious problems. This morning you heard that NATO is about collective defense, collective security, protection of values, defense of values. I'm glad it's not Weltpolizei. I think Weltpolizei is especially impressive in German. Is it possible for one institution, one organization, as powerful as NATO, to manage all those tasks? In particular, we know that the European Union was deepening and widening. As a result, it got into a crisis. But NATO also is deepening and widening, extending its membership, extending its missions, and it also creates problems. And one of them is that while Russia and NATO are no more enemies, and we proclaim partnership, but it's mostly declaratory partnership. There is very little practical cooperation. And there is the two powerful military machines can either cooperate or compete. And there is still a legacy of the competition. And it's very easy for me to imagine a scenario if, for instance, the United States ballistic missile defense interceptors are deployed in Poland or Romania, Russia most probably will respond to this by abrogating the INF treaty. There are many people who are, I think, younger than the INF treaty present in this room. So it's a treaty which was signed at the end of the 80s, banning intermediate-range nuclear missiles. The missiles which North Korea, India, Pakistan, Iran, Israel possess, and Russia does not. I think we are now entering a very difficult period, and we are in a race with time. We have to develop the new mechanisms, the new concept, how to manage this multipolar world. I think NATO is going to play a very important role, but it's not going to be the only institution to manage the balance of power in the new global situation. And we have to be really serious about building strategic partnership between Russia and NATO. Otherwise, we can see resumption of some of the competitions which seem to be over 15 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we move now to our fourth panelist, and it gives me great pleasure to ask Dr. Miyagawa to address us.
Thank you. We appreciate that the NATO has not disregarded a country which is located at the far end of, far opposite end of the Eurasian continent. And I'm very glad that I was invited to this quite honorable meeting. Thank you very much. While Japan attracted attention of the world media in the 70s and 80s, it did not play any security role, major security role at all. Therefore, when the Gulf War occurred, the Americans, who are very usually good at giving us a very pricky word, pricky estimation, described Japan, which is doing too little too late. And as this term became so prevalent inside Japan, even a 12-year-old son of mine started to use this word. So when I was outside Japan attending an international conference, and when I forgot to give my wife a birthday present, a couple of days later of her birthday, I sent her a facsimile from a foreign city saying happy birthday. And my son sent me back a facsimile, "Father, it's too little too late." So of course I sent him a paternalistic tone message, "It's none of your business." But anyhow, ever since then, Japan has tried very hard to find ways to play some roles in, even in the security field, even despite the constitutional constraint. We started our roles in Cambodia, as you know, East Timor. We sent our forces, military forces, civilian forces even, to Indian Ocean to meet the challenges in Afghanistan. We sent our forces to oceans near Indonesia when Indonesia was hit by tsunami. The number of soldiers amounted to over 2,000 then. We also send security forces, self-defense forces to Pakistan when Pakistan was hit by earthquake. Through those activities, we understood that the mixture of ODA assistance with the dispatch of personnel would be quite effective in doing our activities, helping activities in those countries. And so therefore, these activities would certainly continue. And this is the place where we found also the expansion of NATO roles. And therefore, there is going to be that, and this is the area where two perhaps efforts, Japanese sort of expanding efforts and NATO expanding efforts meet together. So therefore, there is a possibility of future collaboration between Japan and NATO. Japan has had a very persistent interpretation of our constitution in which we do not engage in collective self-defense. And this is the reason why the Japanese felt NATO an alien body, because we do not see any possibility of collaboration. And perhaps NATO would have been much more preoccupied if Cold War lasted. But luckily, in the European theater, Cold War ended and NATO expanded its sphere. And also, luckily, we decided to expand our security roles, and there is a meeting place. In Southeast Asia, particularly, there are a variety of concepts, new concepts, to meet non-traditional or unconventional security threats. Collaboration has already started in the field of anti-piracy, anti-narcotic trading, anti-human trafficking, and anti-environmental degradation. And in those areas, we have started to play a certain security roles, and in those areas, we would expect that NATO would be able to collaborate with us. But on the other hand, in Northeast Asia, we still see the residue of Cold War-type confrontation, as you know. The Korean Peninsula is one of those examples where North Koreans are targeting particularly Japan with a huge number of missiles which can cover more than 1,300 kilometers. The distance between Japanese coast and the North Korean coast is only 800 or 900 kilometers. Therefore, most of the cities in Japan are under the menace of any possible missiles attack. On top of those, we have variety. It is possible that North Koreans might be engaged in subversive activities inside Japan because it is difficult for us to recognize North Koreans from the Japanese at the appearance. But anyhow, for these reasons, there are Cold War type confrontation, hard security issues remaining. Taiwan Strait is another. If conflict occurs in Taiwan Strait, certainly U.S. forces will be involved. And if U.S. forces start operation from bases inside Japan, certainly Japan cannot claim neutrality in the conflict. In those areas, hard security issues, we wonder how much collaboration we would be able to have with NATO. Lastly, I would like to mention the changing geopolitical security environment in the Eurasian continent. For instance, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization last year invited as observers Iran, India, Pakistan, and also Mongolia. At the meeting, they agreed at the summit level that U.S. forces stationing in Central Asian Republic should have a clear deadline of departure. Well, U.S. tried hard to set up their bridgehead in Central Asia, but if this particular collaboration amongst the powers in Eurasian continent proceeds, then perhaps those republics which are surrounded by those powers would have to change their colors as like a zero game. But anyhow, in those areas, we would have to look at the future, perhaps difficulty on security issues, and to what extent we would be able to collaborate with NATO is also a problem in future. I'm so sorry that I had to pour a cold water on the euphoria of NATO, which is perhaps enjoying sort of a sense of achievement ever since the end of the Cold War, but I would like to make a short sort of warning shot over to the NATO. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I must say, as somebody who's by profession a historian, I thought I heard the beginnings of the resurrection of the Anglo-Japanese Naval Alliance of 1902, as a potential model, but who knows? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had four very rich, very different presentations, and I'm sure that you'll have questions for our panelists. May I ask you, please, to indicate, and then when I recognize you, if you'd say briefly who you are, where you come from, and make your question as succinct as possible. No statements, please, and we'll get through as many as we can. And we'll start with somebody in London and Harvard. You can be putting your thinking caps on and choosing who's going to ask the first of your questions in a minute. So who would like to start here? That's a very good sign. They've been utterly convincing. Are we going to give London, Harvard, are we going to give London time to think a little further? And we'll go to you, perhaps.
Sure. Hello, can you hear me?
That's fine.
All right. My name is Cyrus Otis. I'm a French citizen here. Part of my studies at Harvard is concerning Afghanistan. So I have questions for Pakistani and Japanese involved there. First, on Pakistan and the peace accord that was signed with North Waziristan, I would like to have your feedback on it. It doesn't seem to stop the Taliban flow from Pakistan to Afghanistan. Second question for Japan, the DDR process, wondering if we did face a failure there, and if that IAG to be efficiently implemented there.
Okay, fine. Do you want me to... I think it's directed
you.
At you,
yes,
I commissioner.
The question relates to the peace deal between tribal elders in North Waziristan and the Pakistani authorities. I think what should be clear is that this deal is anti-Al-Qaeda and anti-Taliban. The pillars on which this deal stands is to ensure that we have tribal cooperation in ensuring three things. First, no Al-Qaeda presence in this area. Number two, no Taliban presence in this area. And number three, no cross-border infiltration from this area. This is the basis on which the deal stands. But I think if I understand the intent of the question, the deal is predicated on the belief, and I think we all share that belief, that ultimately the solutions that we have to find to these very, very vexed problems and issues, the military force and the use of military force is one plank. The other is political reconstruction and winning hearts and minds. This deal tries to implement an integrated and a holistic approach to dealing with this issue of terrorism and the sanctuaries that sometimes are found for people practicing terrorism. So the idea is to be able to ensure through political means now, with forces remaining exactly where they are, because I think there is some misconception that Pakistan has moved the forces out of that area. Not a single soldier has moved from North Waziristan. But as President Musharraf has repeatedly said, the military is there to create a certain environment. And in that environment, you have to allow the rest to be able to function. And that's exactly what the North Waziristan deal does. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Any thoughts arising here in this room yet? A sense of perfect comprehension. In that case, I've got a question, if I may, and then we'll go back to Harvard. Oh, we have a Harvard question. We have a Harvard question. Right. Fire away.
Hi, my name is Blackstock, and my question is to Her Excellency Dr. Murphy. You raised some excellent points about the current discriminatory nature of the NPT. What I'd like to hear from you is a little more elaboration on how you would framework developing that does not have those discriminatory frameworks, and what do you see the new framework looking like, and how would you go about developing it?
I didn't get that, I must say.
I didn't also quite understand.
I'm afraid we didn't understand your question. It breaks up quite a lot. And could you say who it was addressed to?
Uh,
It was addressed to you as well, was it? I think so, yeah. Just speak very slowly.
Are you able to hear me at this moment? Okay. The question is for Her Excellency Dr. Luding. It's particularly in regards to the discriminatory nature of the current nuclear framework and how we can go about developing a non-discriminatory framework for the future of a non-proliferation framework in the world. You described very well the current discriminatory nature, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on how to develop it in the future.
Do you want to comment on this first? I think Dr.
Okay.
Rogoff
all right.
as well.
I think that we have to remember that the strategic stability which the Soviet Union and the United States negotiated between each other during the Cold War was meant to manage their competition. And it was never a fair deal. So whatever agreement we and the Americans had, it was parity for America and the Soviet Union, and mostly big fat zero for everybody else. And it was never a fair deal. Well, it so happened that the British, the French, and the Chinese managed to get some nukes, but very few compared to us. So the non-proliferation treaty was meant to freeze the status quo. And this is a deal which created two classes of nations, those who have nuclear weapons and those who don't. And apparently, we now face a situation when a number of nations believe that their vital national security interests require protection through possession of nuclear weapons. And we basically, I think the international community basically agrees to de facto accept the nuclear status of Israel, India, and Pakistan. And we know how Iran responds to that, and we know that North Korea has already became the ninth member of the nuclear club. And we can expect really a kind of a chain reaction with South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan responding to the nuclear weapons in the possession of the North Korean regime. And Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt responding to the Iranian access to nuclear weapons. So, there is tension between the value of non-proliferation regime as a tool to maintain stability and double standards which are applied to different nations. I personally believe that, the non-proliferation treaty is unfair, but if there are 20, 30, 40 nuclear countries, we really might have a mess. But apparently it's very difficult to maintain the status quo. And while trying to keep the lead on proliferation, we also have to think how to develop the rules of the game for all nuclear countries which exist today. Since the only operational agreements are between Russia and the United States, and in several years even they expire. And then there is a threat of totally unrestricted competition between nuclear powers. This might be an invitation to a doomsday scenario.
Hi, Commissioner, do you want to comment briefly?
Very quickly, the point I was trying to make was that the current crisis of nuclear proliferation are symptoms of a deeper, much more fundamental malaise, which has many components, but I won't go into each and every one of them. But let me mention two. One, of course, I agree with my Russian colleague that the application of double standards obviously has much to do with what we have been seeing in the past several decades. Because I think if non-proliferation rules have to be applied, they have to be applied in a non-discriminatory manner. because if some countries are offered civilian nuclear cooperation in violation of NPT obligations by the NPT states, and others are not trusted to possess the full nuclear fuel cycle, I really don't understand what kind of a regime we are setting up here, or what kind of a regime we are implementing. And the second point, which is responsible, I think, for much of the breakdown that we are seeing, is the fact that the five recognized nuclear weapon states never kept their nuclear bargain in terms of the disarmament, which was essential. It was always supposed to be in sync with the operation of non-proliferation. And once the permanent five, or the five recognized nuclear powers, did not achieve what they promised to achieve, because remember, they had promised to achieve nuclear disarmament within 20 years. Once the NPT review conference of the year 2000 took place, it seems that the whole disarmament agenda was abandoned. Now, I think we can't ignore these factors as factors that are underpinning the present crisis in nuclear non-proliferation. And I'll end there, because I can see you nodding away, saying, hurry up.
No, I wasn't nodding for that reason. I was just going to use the chairman's privilege, since you made the point, High Commissioner, twice, to observe that, with respect, I think it's not correct to represent the declared five as you have done, because all of them, the United States and this country also, have made very substantial cuts in the number of warheads that they've had from the Cold War stockpiles. But I think that the point that both you and Dr. Rogoff raised in response to this question is a profound one, in a sense that I'll surface, which is that the great difference between the Cold War and today was that in the Cold War, nuclear possession held over all of us the sword of Damocles of an uncontrolled catalytic escalation, which could lead to the doomsday scenario. In the hard light of the present day, it's a good thing that that particular sword of Damocles has been lifted. But the corollary of that is that we are in a world in which, put bluntly, the prospect of nuclear next use before we all draw our pensions or pop our clogs must be more likely than in the past. And the question that's before us, and for the whole regime structure, is whether the inherited regimes are actually fit for purpose in that environment, it seems to me. That's the issue that North Korea has actually put on the table in this regard. Anybody who wants to come here in this room yet? Yes, madam, please. Is there a roving microphone? I don't know. Oh, you have to come here. Would you come to the microphone, please?
Hi, my name is Emily. I'm doing a master's in global politics at LSE at the moment. Just to continue what we're sort of talking about, this is for Makio Miyagawa. Sorry, I can't say your name. Do you think that Japan will acquire like nuclear weapons, because there's been quite a lot of talk about it recently in the press, and I was just wondering if we could have your opinion on that.
Okay, everybody get that? The question about whether Japan might move to a formal acquisition of nuclear weapons, declared possession.
Well, thank you for the question. I don't think that Japan will acquire nuclear weapons, but on the other hand, we are a little embarrassed by the countries in the world, one after another, acquiring nuclear weapons. 35 years ago, when we decided not to acquire nuclear weapons and accede to the NPT as non-nuclear state, we argued in ourselves that if Japan becomes a nuclear state, many other countries will follow us, and this is not good for the stability and security around the world. But now, with or without Japan becoming a nuclear state, many other countries are already nuclear states. And in Northeast Asia, we have Russia, China, and now we have North Korea, and of course US, are all nuclear states surrounding Japan. So this is a little embarrassment, but at the same time, we still try hard to, I think, continue to be non-nuclear states as far as the present security circumstances continue. Thank you.
if I could just ask you a brief supplemental to that, would you accept that in the sense that nuclear theorists like Sir Michael Quinlan describe existential nuclear deterrence, that your country already is in that position, because after all, it is well known that if it chose to, it has the ability to move to nuclear possession. It doesn't have to do so, and therefore draws a certain diplomatic advantage simply from that doubt. Or is that too mischievous?
Well, I would rather respond to Professor's question in saying that, as I said, we would try hard to continue to be non-nuclear state, but if, you see, situation requires us, the situation requires means that, you see, if North Korea explodes another bomb, and if North Korea, you see, clearly targets us with missiles with nuclear weapons on it, and if the U.S. might, the U.S. sort of nuclear umbrella might perhaps not work as a deterrent, deterring North Koreans from shooting it over us, then, of course, it is inevitable that we have to consider it. But the situation hasn't come to that extent, and we still try not to let other nations follow North Koreans and perhaps other countries.
Thank you. That's a very careful answer. I take it that you agree that you have existential deterrence at the moment.
Could I just make a comment?
Please do, because, High Commissioner.
I wouldn't like it to be thought that because some countries would say that the regime was inherently discriminatory, that therefore the alternative is to let it rip. I think you've got to ask yourself whether or not you are in favour of minimising, and that was really the original purpose. It's an imperfect world. If you have five nations with nuclear weapons, what do you do? They're not going to give them up. Is it better to have five or 15? Now, what has changed, I think, fundamentally with North Korea is that you have a country that's regarded as a rogue state that seems to have no coherent agenda and therefore does pose very significant threats. Now, the alternative is not to then just say, well, it's not working, let's walk away from it. It's to look at what other weapons can be used in conjunction, and that's where the enforcement regime built into the UN Charter is so important. And if nations aren't prepared to use those sanctions mechanisms in a way that does penalise countries who breach treaties, then of course it will be meaningless and you will encourage others. And of course the real worry is that there'll be no restrictions on the dissemination to not just rogue states but to non-state actors, to people who have no regard for balance of power considerations, who are really in there to cause as much mayhem as possible. And I think that's the real choice you've got to make.
Thanks for that. Now, time is not with us. We've got some time still for questions, but I want to get a sense of how many we might have. Harvard, can I ask you, how many questions have you got there that want to be asked? I can see one standing up.
Two. We have two more.
You have two questions. Right, well, why don't you give your first question now? Then we have a question in London.
Thank you. My question is for High Commissioner Lodi. She mentioned the three items in the framework for consensus building in terms of the NPT, strengthening of the NPT. How would you characterize the U.S.-India nuclear deal? Is this an ideal first step towards those three items in your consensus building process? Thank you.
How would I characterize?
Like to restate the question.
No, I didn't understand. How would I characterize?
How would you characterize the U.S.-India nuclear deal?
Right.
Is this an ideal step among the three steps that you mentioned, which would contribute to consensus building and strengthening the NPT regime?
Well, I think it certainly erodes one of the pillars that I was suggesting should form new consensus on non-proliferation, which must have disarmament and active disarmament by the recognized nuclear weapon states going beyond the cuts, which we know about, but these are not commensurate with what commitments they had given over a period of time, especially the 12 steps that were agreed to at the time of the review conference. So I would repeat that the Indo-US civil nuclear cooperation deal is one example of a discriminatory approach, and therefore is hardly in sync with what I am proposing, which is that unless you have a non-discriminatory framework for the promotion of nuclear proliferation or nuclear non-proliferation as well as peaceful nuclear cooperation, we are going to see problems down the road. Now, in this new consensus, you could build in many new elements, but we do need a new consensus, which is consensus backed, and which is something which is put together by various states rather than something which is implemented unilaterally. I think that's the point. First, a return to multilateralism, two, a return to consensus-based multilateralism, and three, looking at some of these issues and, acknowledging that certain parts of the bargain were not kept, certain parts of the commitments that were made, and I agree entirely with you, the cuts did take place, but not commensurate with what was committed. Plus, at a certain point in time, I think you only have to go and see what's blocked in the conference on disarmament and what has happened to the disarmament agenda. I mean, I'm not telling you anything which is terribly new or unique, but it's a fact. And I think we need to move this forward because obviously the moral and legal authority of the nuclear weapon states, the recognized nuclear weapon states, will be much less if they themselves are not doing very much to move in the direction of more disarmament. That's the point I was trying to make. And as I said, it's not a very new or a unique point, but it's something that needs to be factored into efforts at nuclear non-proliferation.
We'll come to you in a moment, sir. Dr. Rogoff.
I think the American-Indian nuclear deal reflects what I call the multilateral nuclear balance. Since Pakistan has been traditionally American ally, but the United States is making a deal with India on much better terms than with Pakistan, de facto demonstrating that it does not object to India building up her nuclear weapons to catch up with China, to balance China. So we have Indian-Pakistani nuclear balance, then we have Indian-Chinese nuclear balance, and Chinese build up, modernize their forces. We have problems in Chinese-Russian nuclear balance, Chinese-American nuclear balance. It's a system which is much more difficult to manage than it was during the Cold War, when basically what counted was Soviet and American weapons. Everything else was practically not relevant. Here we have all kind of trigger mechanisms to launch this kind of disorganized competition.
Thanks very much. You've been very patient, sir. Please, your question.
Sean Cross, University of Cambridge. It's a question based on something you brought up yourself, Prof, a few minutes ago. It's this idea that, fascinating as this discussion is, and I found it very much so, it's very much based on state-based multilateralism. If that logo wasn't up there, and if they hadn't bought us lunch, would anybody have mentioned NATO at all?
Would you like to address that to any particular member of the panel, or would you like all their views?
All their views.
Dr. Miyagawa, you started with the storm warning. Perhaps we might ask you first. You feel not. High Commissioner?
Well, I suppose you've got to work within the architecture that's available, and in a sense, NATO is a given. That's why we're here. And I don't hear anyone arguing against it or even criticising it. So you've got to assume that people regard it as relevant and able to be effective. The only issue seems to be how extensive its global reach ought to be and what ultimate relationships it might strike. But I haven't heard anyone saying that somehow NATO is not relevant to the solutions. Clearly, it's got to get its work out priorities. It's got to determine just how much it can call in from its member nations, and that's not an easy thing, as we've heard this morning, even getting some helicopters for Afghanistan seems to be beyond its capability at the present time. So there are very serious limitations to what NATO can do, but nonetheless, it's far and away the best bet at the moment if you want to operate through some sort of multilateral structure, and as in nearly every instance with a UN mandate, it's de facto approved by the rest of the world.
I have to give some credit to NATO. Well,
so generous,
let's face it. Because of NATO, the war between Western powers is impossible. So the French and British may have problems, but we don't have mutual nuclear deterrence relationship between the United Kingdom and France. And thus, NATO already provides an element of stability and a very important element covering a number of major powers, what could be described as Western powers. Not all of them, since Japan is also Western power, since Australia is also Western power. And NATO will probably play an even bigger role in the post-Iraq situation, because the United States, after 9/11, said, well, old Europe, well, NATO can, Article 5, forget it, will do everything alone. I think after Iraq, the United States will need NATO more than before. But it's also obvious, North Korea. What NATO can do about North Korea? Russia can, China can, Japan can, the United States can. But NATO is NATO, there it's irrelevant. So it's an important element in maintenance of the global stability. But only one of the elements. It cannot be really the magical tool with which you resolve all the global security problems in the 21st century.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, we're coming towards the end of the session, but I think we do have time for one or two more. Sir, can we go to you, and then we'll go to the last question from Harvard.
Okay, I'm Peng Jianxin from China, as a LSE student. I've listened to the experts, your discussions. It gives me an impression that the collapse of the non-proliferation regime is inevitable, because you are talking about the five nuclear powers. They are keeping their warheads, not disarmament. And North Korea has gone to nuclear. And you are asking about Japan. Will Japan go to nuclear inevitably? So other people are talking about Iran we are going to nuclear. So I'm wondering, as the non-proliferation regime as a collapse, we will collapse inevitably. Is that so?
Fine, thank you. So the question is it actually inevitable the non-proliferation treaty will collapse? Would you like to speak to that?
Thank you. The reality is that the NPT regime is facing collapse, but at the same time, but on the other hand, there are growing sort of arguments around the world on how NPT regime could be maintained. Now it's high time for experts, security experts around the world, how to reduce the risks of proliferation of nuclear weapons, and how we would be able to proceed with any perhaps necessary amendments if there is a need, anyhow to reduce tensions around the world. I have no particular concept, idea right now, but there is a need to perhaps increase debates amongst the experts.
Well, I think non-proliferation regime could be saved and improved. Because not everybody wants to have nuclear weapons. And if we look at the history, 9 nuclear countries, including North Korea, they decided to get access to nuclear weapons only when they faced what they believed was a threat to their survival, really a threat to their vital security interests. The nations don't get access to nuclear weapons for prestige or other reasons. Because nuclear weapons, it's not a benefit, it's a huge burden. But the non-proliferation can survive, in my view, if three conditions are met. First, if the United States, Russia, and other official nuclear powers really will demonstrate that we want to reduce, if not to zero, but to close to zero. Since Russia and the United States today have more deployed nuclear weapons than in 72 when SALT I, the first arms control treaty, was signed. So wonderful outcome of arms control. We have more nuclear weapons than 35 years ago. And the British, the French, and the Chinese should join. Until now they were saying, oh, we have so little, well, we really don't have to do it. Point number two. We have to figure out how to resolve the North Korean crisis and Iranian crisis through peaceful means. If we are able to resolve this problem with these two countries, then we are not going to see the chain reaction I was describing. And point number three, we should think not only about sticks, but carrots. Really, how well nuclear access to nuclear energy or other sources of energy could be used rewarding those who behave nicely. I'm not using diplomatic language, but basically the regime could be saved not only by threatening sanctions, but also by rewarding those who don't do stupid and nasty things.
Thanks. High Commissioner?
I think it's premature to talk about its demise, but again, there needs to be appropriate enforcement mechanisms. I'm not sure that you can simply say that countries don't acquire them for prestige reasons. Iran is not actually under threat. Iran is unilaterally wanting to acquire for purposes of its own, which may include leadership in the region. And whilst you've got countries like North Korea who don't even seem to know what they want to do with it, even if they have acquired a capability, then you've got to ask yourself whether nations are sufficiently concerned to do something about it. Now, I don't think the simple build-up is anywhere near as much a problem as genuine proliferation, which is disseminating to others. And that's what the original purpose was, to limit the number of players, to have this balance so that they each felt that they were relatively safe from attack because they could counter-attack. But it's in the mutual interest of all of those players not to see rogues acquiring weapons capability, and if they do, asking themselves whether they're relaxed and comfortable about it. I wouldn't have thought they were. But carrots is one thing. I mean, we've offered Iran a fair number of carrots to date, and I'm sure that North Korea hasn't suffered from any lack of offers as well, but it doesn't seem to do the trick. So you've got to have something in your armoury to actually make the carrots more attractive, and I think that has to include an enforcement capability through sanctions.
That's a great image, High Commissioner. Beating the carrots makes them more attractive. Harvard, can we go to you, please, for the last of your questions?
My name is Kevin Ferguson here. And this is directed towards Dr. Miyagawa. I'm not clear yet on the practical need for Japan to develop nuclear weapons, given U.S.'s extended deterrence. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that. I know we talked about perhaps crumbling treaties, but whether we're calling it NPT or a Treaty of Mutual Cooperation, with Japan being such a strong ally, such a strategic importance to the U.S., can you imagine any reason why the U.S. would continue to extend protection to Japan? And what practical need would there be besides to assuage some embarrassment of Japan not developing nuclear weapons to go ahead and do that? Secondly, I was wondering if you could speak to the need to whether Japan should, or how involved Japan should be in the interdiction of suspect cargo to North Korea, given North Korea's recent activities. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Howard. And since we're going after this question to be leaving you, can I thank you all very much for your extremely pertinent and interesting questions.
It seems the question was whether there is a relevance of Japan having some partnership with NATO, because we have a good security alliance with the United States. Is it the first question, perhaps?
Well, the first question is about your doubt over the American nuclear umbrella. I think was driving that first part.
Thank you. We have a very good understanding between the two states, two countries, allies. And therefore, I believe that our government does not have any suspicions about U.S. intentions on protecting us. But this is a matter of practicality. You see, we have maintained non-nuclear principles, which include, you see, non-production, non-stationing of nuclear weapons inside Japan, and not allowing entry of nuclear weapons inside Japan. That means U.S. nuclear weapons do not exist inside Japan. And recently, South Korea decided to get rid of American nuclear weapons from South Korea. And therefore, you see, in the region, we do not suppose to see U.S. perhaps nuclear weapons except in the high seas. But it is difficult for U.S. to maintain the nuclear weapons in the high seas, well, practically speaking, all the time. So to what extent North Korea believe the counterattack might come when it uses is a little dubious. And therefore, we ought to perhaps calculate these days to what extent, practically speaking, U.S. deterrent, nuclear deterrent umbrella is extremely effective, so that first strike even would be deterred. Thank you.
Mr. Miyagawa, thank you very much indeed. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for your questions and for your discussion. To the gentleman from Cambridge, in parting, may I say, don't be too hard on NATO alone, because all of the mid-20th century multilateral institutions, the United Nations, the Bretton Woods institutions, the European Union, all of them are under stress. And maybe NATO's been doing pretty well, actually, under the extreme pressure that it's been under just recently. But thank you very much indeed, and that's the end of this session.